Thank you, Judge Connolly, and may it please the court. My name is Mark Bradford. I represent the appellants, Christian Preuss, Eric Preuss, and Catherine Briel. This court should reverse the district court and remand with instructions to dismiss the petitions, reinstate Christian Preuss as trustee, and award the trustees their fees. I want to be the first to acknowledge that an appeal following a bench trial typically comes before the court in a very deferential posture. This case, however, is not such a case. The errors here are legal, they are substantial, and they materially affected the outcome below. In its merits order, the district court, without any request from a party and without any notice or opportunity to be heard, interpreted the trust instrument to mean that the trustees have no administrative authority over the individual lots within the trust property. It then used that sua sponte interpretation as its springboard to override two discretionary decisions that the trustees made for the benefit of all beneficiaries, to dismiss one of the trustees, and to award petitioners a portion of petitioners' attorney's fees while largely denying the trustees their fees. Under any standard, that is error, and it should be corrected. The fundamental problems with what the district court did is that it took its interpretation in the face of a 2011 order, a final order, that expressly concluded that the trustees had authority over the individual lots. The court also did it notwithstanding petitioners' own concession repeatedly at trial that the 2000 order was crystal clear regarding the scope of that authority, and petitioners were not challenging the scope of that authority.
Mr. Bradford,
yes.
Can I interrupt you to pose a question at this point? How do you reconcile then the argument you're making with the specific language of the trust?
Sure.
And the district court, of course, quotes it in her order, and I'm sure you're well familiar with it, but it talks about this period of exclusivity and non-exclusivity, and after 2004, they have the exclusive right to use and enjoy the lot.
Yeah, thank you, Judge Halbrooks, and I'll be happy to reconcile the language, and then I'm going to tell you why I don't think it really matters. But to reconcile the language, paragraphs 2.2 and 2.3 of the trust agreement are quite clear that the trustees have administrative authority over the entire trust res. It refers to the property that is transferred to the trustee under this agreement, which is the entire real property that makes up the Lakeshore property in Ontario. What Section 4 does is it governs exclusive use and enjoyment of certain lots within that trust property. And where I think the district court got it wrong, even if the district court could reinterpret the trust contrary to the 2011 order, is the court conflated exclusive use and enjoyment as excluding the trustee's administrative authority. In other words, the court concluded that if somebody has the ability to use and enjoy the property, the trustees have no administrative authority over that property. That's wrong for a number of reasons, including that in every trust, the beneficiary typically has the exclusive right to use and enjoy the trust res. But the trustee's job is still to administer the property that's the subject of that trust. So it's really, it's in paragraphs 2.2 and 2.3 of the trust that we draw that authority from. But in any event, Judge Halbrooks, I don't think that it really matters in this case because we have a final 2011 order that determines how the trust should be interpreted, and that order is entitled to preclusive effect. I want to
with regard yes, Your to Honor. That order, could I want to focus on that order for a moment. I believe that order specifies that the trustees are authorized to establish rules and regulations for the management, administration, and use of the trust property as they deem prudent, comma, right, subject to their fiduciary standards. So what are we to make of the language subject to their fiduciary standards?
So that is the case that the parties actually tried. Everyone agreed that a fiduciary duty standard should apply. The problem is when the court reinterpreted the trust sua sponte after trial, the court then used that interpretation to apply two very different standards. And in the footnote that I believe is on page 28 of the court's decision, the court even says, I'm using this interpretation to apply a less deferential standard of review than the traditional fiduciary standard that would govern the trustee's conduct. We have never taken the position that the trustees can make any decision carte blanche without any oversight whatsoever. We have always agreed with the language of the 2011 order and Minnesota law, which subjects trustees' discretionary decisions to a fiduciary duty standard. That's the case the parties tried, but it's not the case that's reflected in the judge's findings. And that's the core problem with what happened here, is the court applied a fundamentally different standard in overturning two discretionary decisions. There are two decisions that were overturned here, the one outhouse rule that we've colloquially referred to it as, and then the restriction on John Feeney. The court subjected the restriction on John Feeney to two different standards. Part of it was the appropriate fiduciary standard, and we can talk about why that was, why her findings on that were incorrect. But the other part was the easement standard. And the problem with what the court did in applying an easement standard to trust property is that in an easement, you are only considering whether your rule interferes with one party's use and enjoyment. Whereas at the trust standard, the trustees are required to consider everyone's interests, which is exactly what they did.
And on that point, Mr. Bradford,
pardon me, Your Honor.
What I'm trying to, and I understand your issues with, you know, the whole easement analysis. You know, I mean, I don't know why, you know, I don't know why that was done. But in any event, what I wanted to get a question is, as to the Feeney restrictions, I have two questions. One is, why was the restriction put into in the first place against him? And then second, how did that restriction contribute to the continuing enjoyment of the Family Lake property?
I'm sorry, I didn't get Your Honor.
The second question was, how did the restrictions on Feeney's use, how did that restriction contribute to the continuing enjoyment of the Family Lake property?
Okay, thank you, Judge Connolly. First, how did the restriction come into being? There's a long history here. The initial restriction on John Feeney was a complete ban in 2010. That was a result of a letter and other things, but principally the straw that broke the camel's back was a letter that Mr. Feeney authored in which he lambasted the settlor and the trustee. And you've probably seen the quotes from that letter. It accused the settlor, who's a deeply religious woman, of
right. And I you know, I get why they were mad at him, but what I'm trying to find out is, what was he doing that was affecting the property?
Oh, sure.
Were the restrictions put in simply because people were fed up with him and didn't want to see him at all on the property at all?
So this isn't just a personality conflict, Judge Connolly. And I think you don't have to go any further than the findings that the district court actually made relating to John Feeney's conduct. Separate from the letter, as it relates to the trust property, for example, the district court made findings that his actions contributed to the animosity against him, including not communicating with the trustee about construction activities on the property, constructing a road on the property, whether it's a temporary road or a permanent road. Mr. Feeney constructed a road on the property without consulting with the trustees. So there was activity that directly affected the use of the property that Mr. Feeney was at the heart of. Now,
was that the real, I mean, what I'm trying to get at is, what was the primary reason for the restriction? Was it the use, whatever he did to the property, or was because, you know, he was, by his letters, et cetera, was contributing to family, you know, for want of a better word, family discord?
Your Honor, with all candor, I think it's probably both, but I want to be very clear here about which restriction we're talking about. Because there was a complete ban in 2010 before the first petition was filed.
Well, I'm talking about the restriction that prohibited him from going on the common areas.
Ah, okay. All right. So that is the 2012 restriction. And what's important about that is a couple things, Judge Connolly. Number one, it was a compromise solution. So there was initially a complete ban. And then the trustees in 2012 said, okay, things have happened even since the complete ban. We had allegations by one of the beneficiaries of misconduct by Mr. Feeney, pretty substantial misconduct. But we also recognized the right of Solveig Feeney, one of the other beneficiaries, to have her husband visit the trust property. So what the trustees did is what trustees do, balance the competing interests. So you had a number of beneficiaries who were indicated that they were uncomfortable with Mr. Feeney's presence on the property. Mr. Feeney, who's not a beneficiary, not only given his letter about this, the settler's mother, but because of the allegations of misconduct directed toward one of their siblings.
In fairness, though, Mr. Bradford, in fairness, those were unsubstantiated and ultimately deemed to not warrant anything by the church investigation, correct?
Right. And Your Honor, a couple points about that is the as I understand from the record, and this is reflected in the testimony about that investigation, the Missouri Church, the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod cannot basically convict or find somebody liable of misconduct unless the accuser's allegations are corroborated by another source. So they have a very different evidentiary standard that the trustees are not bound by. The trustees don't make facts. They react to what their beneficiaries are telling them. So they have beneficiaries that are saying, we're uncomfortable with Mr. Feeney's presence, not only due to those allegations, but due to the way he's treated our family members. And you have to look no further than his scathing letter. And the trustees did what they do, and they balance competing interests. And what the district court here did is basically usurp that discretionary authority by saying, well, in my mind, not even having met John Feeney because he didn't testify, you overreacted and you should have done something less. That's not the standard. The standard is an abuse of discretion standard.
Mr. Bradford, I wanted to switch briefly to the removal of the trustee issue, which for me is the one I'm struggling with, particularly because the district court did not use in its analysis any of the factors from the Trust Divine case. But before I get to that, I mean, I agree with you. It's not a conflict, well, speaking for myself only, not my treasured colleagues. I agree with you that it's not a conflict of interest to be the PR and the trustee. But explain to me, isn't it a conflict of interest if you're both of those, and as the PR, you are suing one of the beneficiaries under the trust for what he or she did not comply with as it related to the loyalty oath? Why is that not a conflict of interest?
Well, nothing in that lawsuit, speaking of the breach of contract lawsuit that's pending against Rolf Prius, nothing in that lawsuit affects his beneficiary status in any way. It is separate and apart from any rights that he has under the trust agreement. No one is asking for him to be removed as a trustee. It is simply Mr. Preuss exercising his duty as personal representative to pursue a breach of contract claim on behalf of the estate. That contract has nothing to do with Christian Preuss. He didn't draft it. He didn't author it. It was not a condition of beneficiary status under the trust. It was a condition of inheritance under the will. And that's the whole point of the breach of contract case, is to say, you signed this, so you got recovery from the estate when the settler passed. Because you haven't lived up to the contract terms. Pardon me.
And that's a fair response. But I mean, just sort of stepping back, I mean, would not that dual role where you're suing in the private action, wouldn't that necessarily suggests that you're not going to be treating the beneficiary under the trust in a non-violation of fiduciary duty manner.
Well, I think the conflict, Judge, has to manifest itself in some way to warrant removal as trustee. That might, the argument that you're presenting, Judge, or the hypothetical you're presenting may warrant a judge in the separate action saying, look, you can't pursue this claim on behalf of the estate because of a conflict. But as trustee, he's not bringing the lawsuit in his capacity as trustee of the trust. He brought the lawsuit in his capacity as personal representative of the estate. He didn't sue Rolf Prius in his status as beneficiary of the trust. He sued him because he received money from the settlor when she died. Totally unrelated matters. The agreement that the settlor asked, and pardon me, Your Honor, I'm out of time. Can I just complete my answer to that?
Would you finish your answer, please, Mr. Bradford? Thank you.
Yeah, the agreement that the settlor asked them to sign in 2010 was simply to achieve peace in a very volatile situation. And Rolf Prius signed that document under his free will. And that's an agreement between him and the settlor. And Christian Prius was not involved and should not have been removed in any manner for simply holding Mr. Prius to that agreement.
Thank you very much, Mr. Bradford. Mr. Shepard, you are next. So I'll ask the marshal to set it for 10 minutes. You go right ahead, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor. And may it please the court. The district court granted my client, Solveig Feeney, equitable relief on three issues that were raised in her petition. It enjoined the 2019 ban on her husband's access to the property. It removed Christian Prius as trustee, and it awarded Ms. Feeney a portion of her attorney's fees from the lower court. The district court's decision and the equitable relief granted by the district court should be affirmed for the following reasons. First, appellants have simply ignored the trial court's findings of fact and this court's narrow standard of review of a trial court's findings of fact following a bench trial. The trial court here heard 5 days of evidence, admitted hundreds of exhibits into evidence.
Well, and, I mean, I believe me, I don't think there's anyone more conscious about deference to fact trials than Judge Halbrooks, Judge Corcoran, and I. But I mean, what is all this stuff about this easement? I mean, why is the district court going off on that? Shouldn't it just be applying the plain language of the trust, and either the trustee is abusing his fiduciary duty in the way he's applying the plain language of the trust, or he is not. So what's all this about the easement theory? Or should we just really ignore that? And you know, my language, not certainly not Mr. Bradford's, but sort of view this as some sort of a metaphor. And, you know, if you really look at the language, she's talking about what's going on in the individual lots and what's going on in the common areas, Mr. Shepard.
Right. Let me, I think you've touched on an issue that's important here. And that is whether the court's easement analysis affected the outcome, at least on the issues that pertain to Ms. Feeney. First of all, the court's discussion of easements had no effect on the court's decision to enjoin the ban on Mr. Feeney. The court specifically noted, and this is a quote from the order, that the ban would be analyzed as a potential breach of fiduciary duty. And there's no mention of easements in her rationale for enjoining the ban. And I would refer the court to pages 30 to 33 of the court's decision on that particular point. What the court found here, and I think this is really important, it found that the ban violated the purpose of the trust, which is to provide for the use and enjoyment of the beneficiaries and their families. It also found that the actions of the trustee were motivated by improper motives, bias, and bad faith.
Let's explore that, Mr. Shepherd. So, you know, if the purpose of the trust is to contribute to the continuing enjoyment of the family lake property, you know, there's sort of two ways to look at that. It's like, okay, so, you know, the family enjoyment of the lake property is, okay, no one ruined the property. So no building condos, no building a hot tub, you know, blah, 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 blah. But then the other way is, well, you know, if we're all going to enjoy the family lake property, then we're not going to enjoy it to see your client's spouse on the property based on, you know, all these letters. And I don't want to go into, you know, the back and forth, but, you know, if that's the case, you know, it's the second one, not the first one, then why couldn't they do what they did? Why couldn't the trustee do what he did and, put these restrictions on your client, Mr. Feeney?
I'd say a couple of things. First of all, that I think that would violate Ms. Feeney's right as a beneficiary to use the property like every other beneficiary of the trust with her family. There was a way, if they were truly concerned about protecting other beneficiaries from having to, you know, be around Mr. Feeney,
then they could have done the schedule.
There are all kinds of ways for them to do that. They have used the property on average, the Feeney family, 6 days a year since all this began in 2010. There are plenty of ways the trustees could have achieved a result if that was truly their motivation for implementing the ban, to allow Ms. Feeney to use the property like everyone else with her family and allow others who were so deeply offended by his presence to just stay away during that week or 6 days, whatever it is. That was nothing that they ever considered. And that's borne out in the trial testimony. But I think,
how do you justify, Mr. Shepherd, at the end of the day, you know, you and Mr. Eller brought various individual claims of breach of individual instances of breach of fiduciary duty. You won some, the trust won some. So how do you, and you know, 50%, 20%, but then the trust only gets 10%. I mean, if the trust won some of these claims, which they did, I mean, Judge Robner said they did, how is it only 10%? Isn't that an abuse of discretion? And shouldn't we remand that to take another look at that?
I think, Your Honor, that in an instance where the trial court found that the trustees acted in bad faith and violated the trust, and and the case law supports that as ample justification for the court to deny the trustees fees altogether. The district court decided in her discretion to award them a portion of their fees. And that's well, I think, within her discretion, given the findings about violations of the trust, bad faith, and improper motives. Let me just also say, if I can, a couple of words about the 2011 order, which it seems to be at the heart of appellant's challenges here. First of all, as the court has noted, the language of that order specifically says that the authority to implement rules and regulations is subject to the trustees' fiduciary standards. In other words, that order specifically reserved and left unaddressed the question decided, tried and decided by the court below, which is whether the trustees here violated their fiduciary duties. The second point that I'll make about that is that the order did not conclusively determine the trustees' authority to administer the lots. The meaning of the 2011 order has to be determined from the order itself, which is all of five sentences long, and it's a page and a half. The order does, it doesn't say anything about the trustees' authority to administer the lots. It talks about the settlers.
Excuse me, counsel, though, doesn't it reference paragraphs 29 through 39 of the petition? And isn't that what appellants are basing their argument on?
It is.
At least.
Excuse me. Yeah, you're right, Your Honor. It does refer to paragraphs 29 through 39. But what the court determined here was that the trust itself was unambiguous. And because of the unambiguous language of the trust, which, by the way, the appellants do not challenge here, the court properly determined that the intent of the settlor had to be determined from the trust itself without resort to the extrinsic evidence in the petition. That's exactly what the court did here. I see that I'm out of time unless the court has any further questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Shepherd. We'll now switch to Mr. Ella. And whenever you're ready, sir, you will have 5 minutes.
Good afternoon, and thank you, Your Honors. I want to use my limited time to focus on the loyalty oath. This pledge is neither an amendment of the trust or the will. It's a strange document that purports to flip the duties between trustee and beneficiary, in my opinion, warps the law by requiring the beneficiaries to honor and respect the decisions of the trustee, Christian Preuss. And Mr. Christian Preuss was involved in disseminating this document. He knew his mother was going to send it out. He read it beforehand. He allowed it to be signed. And I think what Judge Robner found is that Christian Preuss, as an attorney, should have known that this was improper, and yet he allowed it to be presented and signed. And I want to tie this.
How is this? I mean, look. I hate referring people to their first names. I mean, you know, Mr. Preuss, the lawyer, was appointed. It's quite clear that the settlor wanted him, and it's quite clear that after thinking about it, she wanted to reinforce his authority, and that's how she came up with the loyalty oath. It seems to me that's just applying. I mean, I don't, you know, speaking for myself, I don't have a problem with the loyalty oath. I mean, you know, I mean, the settlor was adamant that the rules are going to be followed, the trustee's going to be obeyed, and you know, here's how I'm going to guarantee it. And, you know, whether that's a good thing or a bad thing, you know, that just is a manifestation of the settler's intent. I mean, isn't your better argument that, you know, your lot was yours and the way your client was treated was a clear breach of fiduciary duty because, you know, how is this extra outhouse going to ruin the continuing enjoyment of the family lake property and somehow destroy this pristine property? I mean, isn't that your better argument, Mr. Ella?
Well, it's definitely our argument. If you think it's the better argument, we adopt that. But I mean, I wanted to go back in time.
There you go. You'd be surprised how many people can't take a hint when they roll in here.
I just wanted to, you know, my 2 minutes tie up this loyalty pledge because regardless of what it was at the time, keep in mind, you have to go back. Ralph, my client Ralph Preuss signed it before the 2010-2011 petition. So now his hands are tied. Now Christian Preuss goes in and gets this order from the court, and now they're defending their actions now on that order. And I think, again, that Judge Robner found that Christian Preuss should have known that the petition was improper or that the intent of the settlor at that time was irrelevant because the plain language of the trust is clear. And the order was obtained under intimidation, where first Christian Price gets this loyalty pledge. And it's, if you look at the whole history, everything that Christian Price did was attempting to consolidate his power and make himself immune from criticism or challenge. And I think that the court saw that in the history of how we got to where we are. But most importantly, you know, we talked about the pledge, but Christian Price went further than just allowing it. He's now sued Rolf Price for breaching the pledge. And counsel for the trustees tries to say they're completely different. This loyalty pledge mentions the trust like 40 times. It requires, purports to require Rolf to honor and respect the trustee. And at the time it was created, that was Christian. And now Christian is enforcing the agreement, and there's evidence in the record that he's trying to get Rolf to give up his cabin and lot on the trust property through that lawsuit, and that is a breach of trust. That's an egregious breach of duty, of fiduciary duty, and sufficient grounds for removal, regardless of, and I heard Judge Conley say, you know, the lower court may not have cited the right standard, but certainly the actions here, speak louder than words. He sued a beneficiary to force the beneficiary to relinquish his rights under the trust, knowing, and he should have known that that was, all of it was improper. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you very much, Mr. Ella. Mr. Bradford, you'll have the last word, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor. I want to revisit this discussion of res judicata because I don't want it to be missed that res judicata has a unique significance in trust cases. When the scope of a trustee's authority is challenged, as it was repeatedly in 2009 and 2010, the only thing a trustee can do to clarify the scope of his or her authority is to ask a court to construe the trust and instruct the trustee accordingly. The trustees did that. Judge Quam issued an order. The trustees were very clear in their petition in 2010 at paragraphs 23, 34, and 35 that it was their position and the settlers' position that the trustees have administrative authority over all trust property, including the individual lots. That issue was decided, and petitioners said that's crystal clear. What happened here, though, is the district court disagreed with that interpretation and then used that as a mechanism by inferring bad faith and misconduct on behalf of Christian Price for following the 2011 order. And the best evidence of that is addendum page 46, where the district court says the trustee, quote, has taken a position contrary not only regarding how much authority a grantor can exercise over an exclusive use easement, but contrary to the trust language itself, which specifically states that the trustee retains administrative authority only over the common property. And that's in the removal section. So she's essentially saying the best evidence, what I'm throwing up to remove you from this trust, to remove the settler's chosen trustee, is that you've misinterpreted the trust. Well, that interpretation was exactly what the 2011 order held. There is no basis to remove a trustee for following a 2011 order. I want to address.
So didn't the district court also find conflict of interest as a grounds for removal?
Right. So what the district court did is to say the strongest evidence supporting removal is the misinterpretation of the trust. And then the court said there's also, I think, what it referred to as a strange conflict, but the court didn't really vet what that conflict was or how it would warrant removal.
Respond then to Mr. Ella's argument that the lawsuit that you characterized as being completely separate is really designed to require Rolf to give up his rights under the trust?
Sure. You and the court can obviously read that complaint itself. It's public record. There is not a single allegation in the relief requested in that complaint that asks for Rolfe to give up any rights to any property anywhere. The only relief that's requested in that complaint is monetary, and it is the money that Rolfe took from the estate when the settlor died, and the complaint asks that that money be returned. This notion that the complaint is designed to take his property is not supported anywhere in the record in this case, and certainly wasn't presented to Judge Robiner. The last thing,
Mr. Bradford, I'm going to interrupt again. Perhaps yeah. Judge Conley will give you a moment beyond your 5 minutes, but I just want you to respond because I appreciate your argument about the removal of Christian Price's trustee. But I just think, in fairness, when you read this district court order in its totality, the findings of bad faith pervade it. I mean, it's not just failure or, you know, authority with respect to the trust, but I mean, it's all sorts of other actions that the trustee took that he did not have to take in terms of, you know, conveying false information and publicizing things and, you know, kind of gathering the family to a certain mindset. So, I mean, what impact should that have with respect to our decision-making here?
Yeah, I think if you really sift out the district court's findings in this case, they're directly impacted by the court's view that Christian Price has misinterpreted the trust, because she refers to him, for example, as somebody who insisted on being right. Well, remember, he's being challenged repeatedly in 2009 and 2010 in express emails by Rolfe Price and others saying, I'm never going to concede your authority over me. You don't have authority over my lot. And a trustee should be confident in their authority and say, no, you're wrong. This is my authority. And that's what Mr. Price did. With respect to other misconduct, for example, I think there's a finding that Christian Price and the other trustees interfered with the ecclesiastical investigation. And there's no evidence for that. It's a completely unsupported finding. But I think all of the district court's slant against Mr. Price stems from the fact that the court believed he was misinterpreting the trust. And therefore, when he's making rules that affect the individual lots, he's doing so against his authority, and he's doing so punitively because he's exceeding his authority. And that's directly in the removal section of the order where I quoted earlier, where the court is saying the trustee, you know, repeatedly took a position contrary to the trust and contrary to the plain language of the agreement. The last thing I never even got to touch, I apologize, and Judge Connolly may have 30 seconds just to conclude.
Yes, I will give you that.
I never got to touch on the statute of limitations, but what I did want to point out is that as it relates to Rolfe Price, this one outhouse rule has been in the written rules since 2009. That's Trial Exhibit 9. It was again in the written rules in 2011. That's Trial Exhibit 211 at page 2. You can't use a 2019 petition to challenge a rule that was put into effect 10 years earlier. And as it relates to the restriction on John Feeney, that restriction, as the district court pointed out at addendum pages 3 and 7, and again in the footnote on addendum page 28, that restriction was put in place in 2012. Under any statute of limitations, that claim is time barred. Thank you, Your Honors, for your questions today.
Thank you very much, Mr. Bradford. Thank you very much, Mr. Ella. Thank you very much, Mr. Shepherd. Stay safe during the pandemic. We'll now move on to the next case.
Thank you.
Thank you.